Welcome to Trailings. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Oh my God. We're looking at each other and not via Zoom.
Yeah. If you're listening and you've listened to ones in the past, we probably sound really good for a change. Yeah,
and you're, we're in the real mics. I'm not doing this from my closet. It's like we're in, back in Bloomberg
headquarters. We're in Manhattan in the Bloomberg office with all the good stuff.
Looking across the table at one another, just like old times.
It is. We have extra weight
on
each of our bodies, but that's okay. We'll lose it back.
Yeah, I just need to start exercising again. So, Eric, a lot's happened in the last year and a half. I'm really glad that we can see each other across the table from now, but we're not alone either. We have a guest, and I'm really excited to speak with her. She's also here in person.
Yeah, we're all in person for a change, and it feels good. And this guest, besides being my boss, by the way, is the chief macro strategist and equity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. And so on our team, I always go to her, listen to her about just what's going on in the stock market. And not only that, what influences the stock market, things like inflation, value versus growth, how interest rates in the Fed are looking in earnings, right? So I figured, given the markets had a long, nice run since March 2020, since last time I saw you, we should check in on how everything's going from like a macro strategist point of view. And then obviously, ETFs are ways to play those opinions and views. But sometimes it's good to just talk about about 4,000 foot view of the whole thing.
And so to welcome her, I'm going to do a thing. And I'm going to surprise you with this thing. It's going to be my stadium voice. You ready for it?
I don't know.
Gina Martin Adams.
That's terrifying. Thank you.
This time on Trillions, looking into the crystal ball with Gina Martin Adams. Gina, welcome back to Trillions.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's so good to see you.
You too.
In person.
Yeah, you too.
So I remember the last time we talked, and it was like you went some places that I even, reading Bloomberg coverage all day, every day, you blew my mind.
Wow, thank you.
So I want to talk about inflation first. You do a webinar called Inflation Nation. It has been a thing that has been very spooky to the market of late. And will remain, I think, a source of concern for a while. So break it down for us. What's your perspective on it?
Yeah.
And what should people be watching out for?
Yeah. So the reason we called the webinar Inflation Nation is because it's our U.S. equity outlook. So just isolating the U.S. and the global equity market. The U.S. has inflation currently in the 90th percentile of history, of the entire history. The biggest CPI or PPI print on record. PPI was growing 9% year over year as of the last print. We've never seen a number like that before. And everyone thinks that this is a one-time deal. They think that because we're seeing inflation peak and it's going to come down, including the Federal Reserve, as long as inflation is peaking now, it's going to settle at a lower pace and all is going to be fine into the future.
There's a word that gets thrown around a little bit, transitory.
Yeah, this transitory notion. So we wanted to explore that. We talked through, what do you do in an environment where inflation is peaking and coming lower? But also, really, I question this notion that we're going to settle at an inflation rate that looks like the last cycle for a lot of reasons. And most importantly, in terms of implementing investment strategy around inflation, I think this is a critical turning point for cyclical sectors to continue to outperform defensive sectors, for value sectors to really take the leadership baton over tech, consumer staples, large cap growth sectors. And it's because of our sort of secular inflation outlook. I don't think we're going back to the 2010 to 2019 experience at all. I think instead the experience that we've had over the last couple of years is setting us up for a much faster pace of inflation into the long-term outlook. So this whole transitory discussion really takes away from the implementation of an adequate investment strategy that can continue to perform well in an environment where inflation is secularly shifting. It's not just about this transitory argument, which everyone's focusing on because of the short-termism of markets in general. It's really about inflation is going to settle at a faster pace. What do you do? Because it's not the strategy that you had from 2010 to 2019.
And can you just explain why inflation being high would be good for those cyclical sectors? And you said value,
right?
Small cap. yeah. international stocks. Why is it good for those?
So for a lot of different reasons. It's better for cyclicals because higher inflation is probably going to be driven as much by a faster demand cycle than we've experienced in the past. Why are we going to have faster demand growth? Why are we going to have faster GDP growth? In my mind, we're going to have faster GDP growth partly because the private sector in the United States is flush with cash. It's a completely polar opposite the experience we had coming about out of the great financial crisis when nobody had anything. Households were in complete disrepair. They had no cash. They were really struggling to get out from under extraordinary debt loads. Corporates, likewise, really didn't have a tremendous amount of cash. They were able to continue borrowing to fund growth, but they didn't have all this cash stored up. As a function of the fact that we had the most extraordinary expansion in fiscal and monetary policy in U.S. history in 2020, households and corporates in the United States are sitting on more cash than they have ever had. The result of that, I think, is a long-term cycle of much faster demand growth. Everybody talks about the supply side. They talk about the fact that, oh, supply chains are in disrepair and they're going to get better. What nobody's talking about is the fact that we're going to have faster GDP growth probably for a longer period of time than anyone has seen in a long time. That is going to fuel a much faster cycle, which generally benefits the faster earners, the cyclical, those segments of the market that are exposed to the cycle, right? So that's part of it. Also, when you have faster inflation, you generally assume that commodity prices are on the up. Commodity-sensitive sectors do particularly well. We've been through a period of time in which capital spending has been absolutely nothing. There's this coiled spring of pent-up demand for capital spending that should improve the outlook for industrial space. The big laggard in my mind in this kind of market is tech. Nobody wants to get out of their tech stocks. Everybody loves their tech stocks, but I think that that era is largely over.
And why is that?
Environment. Part of it is because tech effectively operates as a defensive strategy. Tech had faster growth when growth was slow. All of the growth sort of concentrated in that one segment, right? And now that growth is more equally distributed across segments, is more cyclically oriented, is more industrially oriented, you have growth opportunities emerge in other spaces. Also, when you have those sort of growers, when you have a very, very slow growth environment, you're much more sensitive to interest rates moving. You're much more sensitive to margins. And tech has ample amounts of ability to borrow. They also have higher margins. So they looked like the darlings of the last cycle from a secular perspective. I don't think they'll be the darlings of the next one.
So that was a pretty U.S.-centric
yes.
explanation. What about inflation elsewhere? Because we won't be alone if that ends up being the case.
Yeah. So what's fascinating right now is inflation really is almost a U.S.-centric phenomenon. It is not happening at an above-average pace in roughly half of the globe. In much of the globe outside of the United States, there's still this really a significant struggle with rates of coronavirus infection via this next Delta variant. Also, very low vaccination rates. So the result is what happens in the U.S. is we have much faster inflation because our demand growth is accelerating already. On top of that, you have much faster inflation because the rest of the world can't supply us with the goods that we've become so accustomed to getting from the rest of the world. So it amplifies the problem for the U.S. Really, the concentration of risk is in developed markets, U.S., Canada, maybe Germany, where you have pretty strong rates of vaccination. You also have some import dependence, some goods price sensitivity still. And it's very concentrated. It's definitely not a global phenomenon. Most of Asia, for instance, has below average inflation prints still.
So you just talked about these areas that were cyclical, and I call them the bench players, value, small caps, and emerging markets. They've been bad for 10 years. At the beginning of the year, they started to break out.
Yep.
Your call was exactly right. In fact, listen to this, that those three areas in ETFs contributed about 33% of the flows up through June. But since then, only 2%. The whole trade, all of those have just fallen off a cliff, basically. And this sort of tech growth has reemerged. You know, ARK and that whole trade, the Qs. And that's been about 6 weeks now, right?
Mm-hmm.
You think that's the head fake. It wasn't that the 5 months before was just another long head fake from value.
Yep. I think that the head fake is the last 6 to 8 weeks. And it may last for another 6 to 8 weeks. It may last even longer than that. But it ultimately, to me, is we probably got a little bit too overinflated in our expectations near term for inflation to really break out in the short term. Inflation indicators peaked in the short term as of May, June, and that took some of the wind out of the sails of the cyclical value trade. That said, none of the long-term charts have really crashed, especially for things like value and financials. Small caps is trading sideways. Emerging markets has been pretty poor, so it's the laggard in that grand scheme of things, but I attribute a lot of that to what's happening with vaccinations. And in my mind, the opportunity is still there. It's just a matter of time before the vaccinations become well-distributed and those economies can start to make their way back.
But and to that point, you know, when you think of inflation going up, I tend to think interest rates would be correlated with that. But the past 6 weeks, rates have dropped.
Yep.
And so we've had a rush into Treasury ETFs. Again, you think that is a temporary thing?
I do.
Thing?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a function of the fact that inflation expectations peaked in the short term. I think the Fed has played a little bit of a part in this as well because the bond market is appears to be starting to get a little bit worried about the Fed normalizing policy, and the bond market is doing what it does every time over the last 10 years. Anytime the Fed's talked about normalizing policy, everybody
tantrum.
Runs to bonds. Yeah, there's just a big tantrum, and they just think, oh my God, without the Fed, how can we possibly survive this? And so everyone rushes back into bonds, and then we realize, oh, actually, the economy is still fine. It's just a matter of time, in my mind. There's just a little bit of a freak out in the short term. I think it's great, frankly, for the longevity of the trade that folks are so paranoid that it was a short-term blip. The value rally was such a short-term blip. I mean, when we look at the long-term charts, it was barely even a recovery. The value factor is still extremely cheap relative to the rest of those factors. So but you do have to have a view that you're going to settle into a longer a higher pace of inflation longer term, and that rates are ultimately going to go higher in order for the value trade to work. I think that the market is just sort of really struggling with that view right now.
And in ETF land, if you were going to, you know, take that thesis and run with it, who potentially looks like the big winners and breakout stars?
Yeah. So again, value ETFs have taken in $54 billion through May. Their old annual record is 30. So they're through half a year, they've broken the annual record by almost 50%. Mm-hmm. That's how crazy people got for value. I just worry, you know, and small caps too, although to a lesser extent, but value ETFs in particular, a lot of the flows into ETFs are off these models that have these signals, and a lot of them are technically driven. And I do wonder, because I've seen a couple little, it's almost like spring leaks in a dam of flows out of the value ETFs. And I'm wondering, if value crashes between some moving averages, do the models get triggered and all of a sudden it's this downward spiral and it's worse? Because it seems to be 6 weeks, you start to get to a point where the technicals break down, no?
Yeah, you do. And there's also this coincidence of value and momentum right now, where if momentum breaks lower, it's going to be because value is breaking lower and vice versa. So there's some additional risk because value stocks became momentum stocks in the short run. That said, as long as they hold the long-term trend, then the sky's the limit.
There's
right?
There's so much head fakery going on in there.
Yeah. By the way, there's an ETF called MTUM, which is the iShares Momentum. It's the biggest momentum ETF in the world, really. It only rebalances once every 6 months. And it went from all these tech and growthy sectors into financials and sort of more defensive areas on May 31st. Literally, the day later, the whole thing reversed. It was like, oh, it might be the worst rebalance in history. Although, if Gina's prophecy turns out, it'll all work out. But that's the thing about rebalances. Every six, you know, some are quarterly, some are monthly, some are, but a semi-annual, you're locked in to those stocks. And you're right, momentum and value are kind of tied together for a while, right?
Yeah. And that's going to create, that could create some turmoil short term, but it also could create a much longer term tailwind that everybody's ignoring, right? Momentum typically is a pretty good strategy. It just breaks every now and then. But longer term, if you're in the momentum stocks, you're generally outperforming. It's been a long time since we've been in a market where momentum and value together worked as well. But if you look over the long-term history, that's sort of the magic sauce, if you will, is to have some momentum and value exposure in your portfolio usually outperforms a broader market.
And momentum, when the academics and the practitioners do it, they usually don't use the last month.
Yes.
And it's for this reason, because there's these noise and head fakes.
Right.
Right. So again, though, we're now beyond a month, though, so we are getting into a point where it's possible it starts to show up.
It does. I think that it's a tricky market also because the Delta variant has played a part of this, right? We talk a lot about inflation expectations, but the fact that we saw infections rising around the world again did create a flight back into defensive strategies. But when you see things like the big FAMIG stocks, the biggest stocks in the S&P 500, all tech-centric, still commanding an extraordinary premium over the rest of the index. When you see the U.S. still commanding a 20% premium over the rest of the world, even though earnings are not going to grow faster than the rest of the world over the next 12 months, you know that there's some imbalance. And ultimately, these imbalances reconcile themselves. I think right now you're just at a point in time where very consistently, when infections are rising, U.S. stocks outperform. And when infections are falling, U.S. stocks underperform. You got to get to a point where infections peak again. It's so simplistic, but it just works. And people move defensively as infections are rising. And as soon as they peak, they start to move offensively again. And I just think that's played a huge part of the last month, probably 6 weeks, maybe even 8 weeks, where folks get worried about this Delta variant and they play that strategy. But it's very short term. I mean, longer term, I think many of us feel pretty optimistic that ultimately we're going to get vaccinated, we're going to figure this out, and things are going to change. At the same time, you cannot ignore the fact that policymakers are completely on your side. It kind of blows my mind, frankly, that we're this far into recovery and the Fed is still operating a crisis era monetary policy. We're still talking about spending more money out of fiscal policy, despite the fact that we're at all-time high share of GDP in fiscal spending.
Now, you know I could go into my Boomerati theory right now, why don't you ask about the Fed?
Boomerati is so tempting. But I mean, you're going to tease that. We're just going to put it on a shelf.
It's like Mean Girls. I'm trying to make this a thing.
Yeah, we're going to come right back to it. Okay, so the Fed chairman, Jay Powell, going to be probably at the Fed a little bit longer, although, maybe jury's still out just a little bit longer on that, but that will be a topic of conversation in the coming weeks. What do we expect from the Fed? And like, there will be some shakeup. Like, not everybody in the Fed will be in the same places when they get done playing musical chairs, right?
Yeah.
So what can we expect? I mean, obviously, as you just said, we've had a really dovish run. Is there any reason to believe that it turns hawkish really quickly with inflation on the rise?
No. I think that the Fed has made it really clear. They've started to move the needle on what will make them change policy as well. And they've started to basically guide the market to say, look, we're willing to tolerate much faster inflation than we have in the past. We want to resolve social inequities. This is not language that we've typically heard from the Fed, maybe even since the 1960s. This has not been a huge portion of monetary policy making. We're going to use average inflation prints. The standard inflation measures are inadequate. So this is a lot. All of this to me says, this Fed is going to remain easy to force the hand of inflation to be higher than it has been in a very long time. And the Fed is very supportive of inflation strategies. Now, will they ultimately have to catch up and probably create a slightly more painful environment for risk taking? Yes. But is it going to be within the near term? No, because especially if you think about what's going to happen next week, what's your immediate thing to say if you're a Federal Reserve chairman that wants to err on the side of dovishness? You talk about the Delta variant threatening growth. And you talk about how we're not 100% certain that things are going to be better, so we don't need to worry about easing policy. So I think that the excuse wagon can go on for a very long time, especially if inflation rates are peaking in the near term. As long as those inflation rates are coming down, there's just no reason for them to get too concerned. And they've told us they're not going to be. So there's no reason to err on, any other way. Now, personally, I think they should be tightening like crazy already, because I think that the economy is absolutely on fire and no one wants to acknowledge it for whatever reason. It's very unpopular to do. But they're not going to.
What? Okay, so let me drop a theory on you. Okay.
Oh, God. Is this the boomer? So, are you going to bring up the boomerati? You're going to force us to talk about this.
I am. So, okay, the U.S. stock market is the since we went to 401k plans, all of our money is now in the stock market. That's we don't have pensions anymore. And so isn't there a theory that the Fed can't let it go down? And then if you think, who owns the U.S. stock market? I don't know the number. I think 80% of it is owned by boomers. First of all, only 50% of the country owns stocks.
Yes.
So by the Fed pumping up stocks, you are leaving behind 50% of the – that's a whole other story. That's the wealth gap. But by keeping that –
and an equity one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by keeping the 50% up, you certainly are allowing the retirement funds of America to be cool. And since the boomers have almost all of that money and the boomers are totally in power, whether it's Trump or Biden, they're both boomers, whether it's Powell, whether it's the people leading the big asset managers – and a lot of them go and work with each other. Like one person will leave the Fed and then go work at BlackRock and vice versa. Is there – what about this theory that – I call it the boomerati. Maybe there's a better word for it. That class of people in power will never let the stock market go down. They can't. It's their retirement money.
Well,
Mike dropped. I stumped her. She never thought of it. It's that crazy.
The mic was made of tinfoil.
So I don't think that it's possible to never let the stock market go down, right? The stock market crashed 30% in 3 weeks last year. It crashed more times in the last 10 years. We had more 20% corrections in the last 10 years than in any 10 years in history.
Well, when I say crash, I mean like a real good one. One that rips your face off. Like
we had a 50% crash in 2008, well, another 50% crash in 2000.
Yeah.
We have actually been through over the last 20 years the reality of the situation.
Yeah, but the Fed was not really coddling the market in those two crashes.
Oh, they definitely coddled the market all the way through.
Because we had Scott, I forget his last
just
name.
They
but he
increasingly
was
coddled the market. I will agree with you there. But they've coddled the market all the way through. And yet the past 20 years, we've been
now.
In a bull market. But it's been a very volatile and, frankly, extremely difficult bull market to make money in because you've had these very frequent and very vicious corrections in the equity market. Now, I think that the equity market historically goes through massive bull phases and massive bear phases, and we just happen to be in a massive bull phase. Is it all because of the Fed? I don't necessarily believe that. And, I do think that there are financial centers of power, and, you know, I would love to glom onto a generational sort of battle, but I'm not sure.
He's been on Twitter a little bit lately.
I'm just not sure that, you know, that there is any
I'm hanging
way,
out with crypto people too much, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Fed does get very sensitive. To be fair, though, the Fed does get very sensitive to corrections in the equity market. And the fact that they respond as fast as they do would suggest that they do believe the equity market has something to say about the economic outlook. Let's just leave it at that from me.
Yeah. And we asked the Janus 20 manager who was managing that fund in 1999 and 2000 when the internet bubble burst and it went down 50%, as you said. And we asked him in our interview, you know, did it go through your mind that the Fed would step in and help? And he goes, no, I never had that thought. Now, if market goes down 5% off its all-time highs, people are like, where's the Fed? So I also think the investor base is now a little spoiled.
Well, it's also the market is very correlated to what happens in the Fed. The market is obviously clearly, you know, bought into the idea that the Fed is a credible driver of stock prices to some degree, at least. I mean, every time they've tried to normalize the balance sheet, it's created turmoil for stocks. In both 2008 and in 2020, as soon as the Fed stepped in with massive intervention, it created a new upswing. So it's very relevant for sure.
One of the things that you tell me sometimes, and I also see people talk about on Twitter, is who's leading who? Is the bond market leading the stock market or is the stock market leading the bond market? I think a lot of the bond world is a mystery to most regular people too. Mm-hmm. I think stocks are more, I don't know, in their face. But can you talk about that and where you think that stands right now?
Sure. I do think the bond market generally leads the stock market. I mean, look, obviously the cost of capital is determined in large part by where interest rates are. So the bond market does matter. Where I think we lose the plot a little bit is in the long-term perspective. So for the last 20 years, stocks, prices, and bond yields have been very positively correlated. So when bond yields rise, stock prices rise, and vice versa. The 20 years prior to that, it was the opposite scenario. What's the big difference there? For the last 20 years, we've been contending with deflation, disinflation. For the 20 years prior to that, the general psychology was inflation is a bad thing, right? That psychological shift, or real economic shift even, created a very different relationship between stocks and bonds. And I think you want to keep your eye on this very carefully going forward, because in my view, we could be at a critical turning point where at some point, rising bond yields is no longer a good thing for stocks. It's not anytime soon. Right now, we still need bond. We can still tolerate much higher bond yields from where we are. And the bond market will likely lead the stock market, because higher bond yields is great. It indicates an improving economic outlook, improving sentiment toward risk. Lower bond yields is generally not so good, generally leads to worsening economic conditions. And the bond market is usually pretty keen to forecast this correctly.
Love that. As long as we're talking about relationships, are there any other ones? This is what I'm talking about, like going big with Gina. Are there any other relationships like that that you think astute investors should be watching going forward?
There are quite a few, actually. that's the big, overwhelming secular relationship that I think is absolutely most important to keep your eye on. The other thing that I think you want to keep your eye on really carefully is inflation expectations, because I think we've gotten accustomed to this notion that any bursts in inflation expectations are very short-lived. It's kind of like the value story. Any burst in value outperformance has got to be short-lived, because it hasn't happened and they have not endured over time. But we've gotten a number of new inflation prints over the course of the last 6 weeks, six to eight weeks, that have suggested that this inflation may endure. We're starting to see signs in wages that suggest the inflation conditions may endure. And a wage price spiral starts with consumers saying, I think inflation is going to be higher for a longer period of time, going to their employer and demanding higher wages. And then you get a spiral, right? Yeah. And then inflation stays stronger. And it just reads to me, the economic landscape reads to me right now, that we may be at that turning point. So I think you want to watch inflation expectations really, really carefully. In the short run, everything is going to revolve around peak growth. We've got peak growth in inflation in short term, peak growth in inflation, peak ISM surveys, peak earnings growth. It's just peak everything this summer. And the sequence of momentum in growth does matter for investment outcomes. I think it's the underappreciated story of what happened in the last 6 weeks. We've got peak everything. Where do we go from here? We've got to absorb the idea that we're no longer going to see that persistent upward momentum in every indicator that we follow. So that's another thing that I'm watching.
And back to the bond thing, which is the connection there. When you talked earlier about yields and stock prices, I want to just invert that and say that what you were saying is that bonds and stocks move together lately.
Yeah.
Right. So if you have a 60-40 portfolio, which a lot of people do, what are you supposed to do with that?
Well, it's worked.
If they both
actually
go down together.
Yeah. Well, the yield rises when stock prices rise. So bonds sell off when stock prices are rising.
But that's typically, 60, 40, right?
That's
but
what's happening now.
But
yes.
Over the past 10 years, they sometimes will start to move in tandem.
Yep.
Everybody just sells everything. That's what happened in March 2020.
Crashes, yeah. In crashes, what often happens is the bond market actually just absolutely rallies to the end of the earth and the stock market crashes. You know, the 60-40 portfolio in part has worked as well as it has because of this relationship that's occurred over the last 20 years. There are a lot of people, you know, you talk about broader diversification. There are a lot of people really struggling with, if I move into an environment in which stocks and bonds are no longer correlated to the degree that they have been in the past, and inflation is a very different concern, how do I structure my portfolio? I think this is one of the reasons, one of the other underappreciated reasons why people are pushing into crypto.
Right.
It's an alternative asset. People are taking from their bond allocation and putting it into alternatives of any description, crypto being part of them, but private markets being the biggest chunk, where they're saying, look, I can't tolerate an environment where the bond market and the stock market aren't correlated consistently over time in my portfolio. What do I do in that scenario? And it's one of the most critical questions for a longer-term asset owner allocator in my mind.
I have one that just is a little off topic, but it's, I mean, I'm related. It's on topic, but I've been doing a lot of research into Jack Bogle, the Vanguard founder, for a book project. And in many of his books, he talks about where returns come from for stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great way to sell an index fund, because if you buy an index fund, you're sort of buying the internal rate of return of the whole enchilada. Mm-hmm. It's not as average or basic as it seems. You're actually riding capitalism's coattails. What do you get? He says there's two things: earnings growth and dividends. That's really it. I mean, that's what you get in return. Then there's this third element that's a little bit of a devil, which is speculative return. That is where PEs go up really high, and that's where people lose their minds behaviorally.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was in his book, and when I interviewed him last about 5 years ago, he said, according to my calculations, those two things, earning growth and dividends, we're only going to get 4-6% from the stock market over the next decade. Well, it's been like triple that. So are we living on borrowed time? Is there too much speculative return? I mean, how much do we have to give back at some point to be back on that math?
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of nuance around this, right? Because it's really free cash flow. It's really cash flow that you're talking about, right? Because cash flow drives both the earnings growth and the dividend. If a company is it creating positive long-term cash flow, that's what's going to drive both of those factors and drive the price. And cash flows have been relatively low, but you get an artificial inflation in earnings growth, even if cash flow is low, if interest rates are low and tax rates are low. And that's the environment that has cultivated a much stronger stock market return, in my mind, than you would have had just given if you were just looking at cash flow growth. You also, as a result of the fact that you have those low interest rates, you've had an inordinate period of time where buybacks have dominated, and buybacks change the EPS calculation. So you don't have core earnings, but if you look at EPS, the company looks quite different because your share count is being reduced. So there are a lot of nuances around this. I do think ultimately that you derive the value of a share price via the cash flows of the company. I totally agree with that. But I think you do need to discount those cash flows at a certain interest rate in order to get the actual value.
I also think
you want to pay attention, though, because if we go into an environment where interest rates are rising on trend and taxes are also increasing on trend, it creates a very different scenario for bottom line earnings than we've had in a long period of time. But maybe we can have faster cash flows to make up for that.
Right. I guess that's the question. And that's also where, you know, the idea that inflation lifts rates, which would then you'd have some of these high flying stocks would sell off a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is why ARK tends to be pretty correlated to rates lately. ARK has been like, I don't know, it's like you've got the SPY, then the Qs, and then ARK's really out there in terms of being into some of the really growthy names. And then so there's a lot of people are looking at ARK as sort of a being sensitive to rates.
Yeah.
Because they buy a lot of those stocks that might not have the cash flow.
Well, and they look like they don't have the cash flow necessarily, but they also, in an environment where growth is perilously low, look amazingly strong, right? If you can sort of think about the theory of innovative companies as these are the fastest growing companies in the world in an environment where there is no growth, they look amazing. Well, what happens in an environment where growth is much stronger and more distributed across industries? Suddenly, maybe that doesn't have quite the panache that it had in the past, right? And I think that that's part of the thesis that we have is when you're in an environment where there is no growth to be had, sure, a lot of these companies look amazing because the growth is all concentrated in their names and they have all the potential of the future. But if the future starts to look a lot brighter and a lot of other industries start to participate in that future, which have been sort of boxed out of the growth environment for so long, all of a sudden your investment opportunity set broadens. And you can think about buying an industrial company. You can think about buying a consumer company. God forbid, you might even, you know.
Oh, my God, buy, like Walmart?
You know, something else beyond tech.
I do think they're going to come out with like an ETF, like stuff you need ETF. Like they're going to start to relabel staples into catchier things.
We should have asked about STUF as ticker.
Yeah, I know you want that's for the big one. One other question I have for you, and the way you talk about growth and the economy, and you and I discuss this a lot, which is being bullish, being optimistic, you're generally going to get wealthier.
Yes.
That said, as an analyst who's looking for readership and to make noise, it's tempting to be the bear, to be the top caller, to be the big, short, cool guy, right? You obviously don't do that. You tend to generally look at the bright side. You find things in the data. And if you're following you, you've made more money than the person, because we know there are some who are constantly looking at what's going to go wrong. And it looks good. It looks sophisticated. It looks like you're caring about the about everything.
Right.
And there's no opportunity cost. No one ever goes back to the bears and says, oh, you were wrong. I went,
right.
Whereas the bulls, God forbid the market goes down, they're like, Gina, you said it was okay. So can you talk about that idea of taking the optimistic road as an analyst?
It's very 1990s, right? I mean, it maybe is a function of my age. I don't know. But I think it's due to just the popular psychology of the last 20 years, particularly in the equity markets. Since the crash of 2000, it has been very popular to look over your shoulder for that next crash anytime you can. You know, to the degree that you write an article or publish a thought piece on that appeals to popular psychology, you're more popular. Fortunately for me, I just don't care if I'm popular. I just want to be right. But, you know, that you could say the opposite was true in the 1990s. I would imagine if you were writing articles of optimism, you were, you know, very popular in the 1990s. It was a very strong bull market condition where everybody had optimism about the future of equities. It's just very different. It makes me feel great about the durability of the longer term bull market. You know, as long as it's very unpopular to be positive, it's probably the right call.
In other words, not everybody is so enthusiastic where you feel like, wait, everybody's losing their mind here in a positive way.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. As long as we're always looking over our shoulder for that next big risk, then you probably have a much more rational market in general. It's very healthy to constantly be looking for risk in general. It's tough to be an optimist in that crowd and get attention. nonetheless, it's been the right call. So I'll stick with that.
Okay. I've got a final question, which is, it's mid-year review season here at Bloomberg.
Is
there anything that Eric needs to work on?
Oh my gosh. I don't think I can possibly air that.
There we go.
Eric's been great.
Gina, I got one other one for you.
Okay.
And I think I've asked you before.
Oh no.
Favorite ETF ticker?
I don't know that I have one, but I really like MTUM because I'm a technician. So the only reason I like it is momentum.
Yeah, MTUM.
Yeah. The only reason I like it is because I do believe that momentum is, over the long term, a very, very viable equity strategy. So I would just buy momentum if I had to buy any individual factor.
That's good. Nobody's ever said that.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Mic drop.
That's good.
Yeah, sorry. It's not that exciting. But.
Gina Martin Adams, thanks so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.